You can deny all the things I've seen, all the things I've discovered, but not for much longer. Because too many others know what's happening out there.
I want to believe.
Hi, this is David Duchovny, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby.
New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in Conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org. It is only through a change in human consciousness that the world will be transformed. The personal and the planetary are connected. As we expand our awareness of mind, body, psyche, and spirit, and bring that awareness actively into the world, so also will the world be changed. This is our quest as we explore new dimensions.
Gustave Flaubert was an influential French novelist who was perhaps the leading exponent of literary realism in this country. He lived and wrote in the 1800s, and one of his most famous novels was Madame Bovary. His last complete novel was Sentimental Education, which is considered to be one of the great French novels of the 19th century. Our guest today is also a novelist, and she has said that writing and reading fiction can be an exercise in empathy, and empathy, in turn, can create compassion, and there's no denying that we need more compassion and empathy in these threshold times. Today, we'll be looking at the art of fiction and what prehistoric times have to teach us in this postmodern era with our guest, Dr. Mary Mackey. Mary Mackey is an American novelist, poet, and academic. She is the author of 7 collections of poetry and 14 novels. Her most recent novel, The Village of Bones, is a prequel to the 3 other novels of the Earth Song series. Altogether, these novels cover 30 years in the lives of the people of Neolithic Europe, and about 26 years of Mary's writing life. Join us for the next hour as we explore the matristic culture of prehistoric times with our guest, Dr. Mary Mackey. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. I'll be your host. Welcome to New Dimensions. Mary, welcome.
It's a pleasure to be here, Justine.
It's a pleasure to have you as well. In that introduction, I mentioned the term matristic, and people may not be aware of that term. We think of these times, prehistoric times, maybe as matriarchal, but you make a distinction. So what is that?
Well, the distinction between matriarchal and matristic, it's actually the distinction between patriarchy is men in charge. Matriarchy would be women in charge. It would be the flip side of patriarchy. Matristic is a more collaborative, partnershiped, communal way of governing. It's a way in which the earth is seen as a great mother that brings forth life and is worshipped for that. But at the same time, it's not a society in which women exercise over men the same kind of power that you would have in a patriarchal society that men would exercise over women. So it's a gentler term. It's a more egalitarian term.
So it sounds like it's feminine-based. Mm-hmm.
This is because these cultures were goddess-worshipping, and therefore the cultures had women and men in high positions, but many of the higher religious positions were female positions because the idea of the earth as a mother that brings forth life brought forth priestesses who were representatives of the Great Mother. Now, sometimes these priestesses were men, but I think they were more frequently women. Research seems to indicate that. And sometimes they were of indeterminate gender, something which you may have noticed in The Village of Bones in my novel, where the major priestess of prophecy or priest of prophecy has no specific gender. So it's a more inclusive term.
So what were the archaeological indications of this that you say that it's...
Right. Well, since I'm a novelist, not an archaeologist, I can only draw on secondary sources. And my major source was the work of the late Maria Gimbutas, a professor at UCLA, who did extensive archaeological research in Europe. And this is a story about European culture. And one of the things that impressed me the most is a series of little goddesses sitting around in a council. And these goddesses are snake goddesses, and they're all women, and they're sitting in a console. They're actually sitting around, obviously running something, having some kind of power that way. There are also the images that, and most of what we have, by the way, is ceramic and pottery. If there were images in wood and straw, those have not survived. But the images we have are mostly female images from these cultures. And another one, for example, when I went to Romania and Bulgaria, I saw in the museums these images, these altars to the bird goddess. And they're often female bird-like creatures that are half female, half bird. And some of them were actually dovecots, where the birds could actually nest in them. So they were both a combination of the birds and the goddess imagery. So there's a great deal of female imagery from these cultures.
So when you say that the women were in council, was this like a single piece that had all
yes,
these
that had all of these, yes, all these little different women sitting around. In fact, I have photographs of it on my website, and it's a lovely little piece. They're small. They're in miniature.
Uh-huh.
They're very, very
so
pretty.
If people want to see that, go to marymackey.com. And
yes.
Mackey is M-A-C-K-E-Y.
M-A-C-K-E-Y. And you'll see on that website something that says photographs from 6,000 years ago. Well, obviously, I don't have a time machine. I didn't take them 6,000
right.
years ago. But these are the artifacts from 6,000 years ago.
Right.
And you can see a whole display of these female images of worship.
Well, that just reminds me when you say 6,000 years ago and we don't have a time machine. But you have said that imagination is can be lead to empathy, and empathy can be a kind of time travel.
Mm-hmm.
What did you mean by that? That's such a provocative statement.
Well, I think that, cultures change, political situations change, worlds are discovered, destroyed, abandoned. I mean, all sorts of things happen historically. But I think the basic human emotions, and you mentioned Flaubert earlier, the basic sentiments, and sentimental education is about the education of sentiments, the basic human sentiments remain constant throughout time. And so when you see people, the people that I write about are fairly advanced. They have weaving and bread making and such. But if you go back even farther, where people have stone axes, and they're not less intelligent than we are. They don't have less feeling for their children. They don't have less desire to live. They're like we would be if we had grown up in those cultures, changed by the cultures, but not changed with the human emotions. I think there's a basic humanity. And I think that literature can put you in the skin of other people, in the footsteps of other people, and let you live other lives in other cultures and other ways and understand your connection with them. I think it does build empathy. I think it's a very important part of education. I spent many years as a professor teaching literature, and I think literature helps us learn not just what happened, but what the people were like who made it happen.
I'm just recalling someone who said this about the recent gathering of women and men in some marches that mm-hmm. happened in January of 2016. They happened all over the world.
2017.
Excuse me. 2017, exactly. Oh, my goodness. Where am I? And they commented on all the different signs that people were carrying.
Mm-hmm.
There were like all sorts of different issues that were mm-hmm. being brought up mm-hmm. throughout the crowds. And someone pointed out that the underneath, the bedrock underneath all of those issues was the issue of empathy and kindness.
Mm-hmm. And healing and compassion.
And healing,
I think,
and
that
compassion.
That is the antidote to hatred and attacks and discrimination. One of the major antidotes is to understand other people as people and feel compassion for them. I mean, that is in some ways, our great duty in life is to become more loving and compassionate, I think. I think that is if you had a purpose in life, I think that would be one of your major purposes.
So going back to your novels, what is the importance of looking at these prehistoric times, this old culture in mm-hmm. Europe, the change that's going on there first describe the change that is going on.
Well, the change is, it looks like that for 10,000 years approximately, more or less, there were these stable, small villages. There were actually a few cities in Europe. They lived in relative peace. The horses was not in Europe. It had died out after the last ice age. And I think partly because of this, you don't find signs of genocidal warfare. You don't find signs of heavy differences between the sexes. People are buried in graves that have pretty much similar tools, men and women. You don't find great, gender dimorphism in this kind of thing. And what you have is you don't find fortified villages. You don't find weapons of war. You don't find weapons that are, you find obviously axes and knives to skin animals and things for hunting, but you don't find a panoply of war weapons. What happens about the period my novel starts and which is about is that there's an invasion from the steppes of what's now the Ukraine, the Eurasian steppes, and the horse is reintroduced by nomadic people who don't worship the earth. They worship the sky. They're sky worshipers.
Well, how did that come about? Do you have any speculation?
I have theories about it. No one knows, of course.
Yes.
I have the theory that it was very rough in the steppes and the earth
hard,
cold, dry, difficult. It's not an agricultural situation.
Nothing to stop the winds.
Nothing to stop the winds. And you're not growing plants out of the earth. You're herders. You're living in herds. And the sky is huge above you, full of stars. And, that's the dominant moment and on the steppes would be that. But be that as it may, we don't know. All we know is that they were a patriarchal culture. We know they're patriarchal because you find these grave mounds called kurgans, these huge mounds in which you find chiefs, leaders who are buried with lots of gold because they're very interested in gold, and they've slaughtered horses in the graves, and they've slaughtered their dogs, and they've slaughtered women and children and put them in the graves with them. So you see a very different sort of social organization.
So you'll see one male figure.
One major male figure with lots of stuff, and then women, children, horses, and dogs sacrificed in the same grave to accompany him probably to the afterlife.
Whereas the other graves...
The other graves are communal. They're often family graves. DNA says there are people with just small artifacts. Nobody has apparently, we can't tell, but it doesn't look like anybody's been sacrificed along with people. They're buried in... often sometimes womb-shaped cavities in the earth in the older cultures. And so what happens is when these cultures come in, it takes a long time for this invasion. I mean, this is not like Hitler rolling into Poland. It doesn't take a couple of days. It takes 1,000, 1,200 years for them to come in. But as soon as they start coming in, you see the first fortified villages in Europe. You see the signs of the older culture burned, people slaughtered genocidally, and the forts built on top of them. You see the sacrifices in the graves. You see weapons of war. And what you see is that the horse, not the four of the horses, you see a genocidal warfare and conquest entering Europe. And you see a religion entering Europe that no longer worships the earth as sacred.
So we'll talk more about that in just one moment. I want to remind our listeners that I'm here with Dr. Mary Mackey, and she's the author of many novels. Her most recent one is The Village of Bones, Savala's Tale, and it's a prequel to the other three novels in the Earth Song series, the first of which is The Year the Horses Came. And if you want to know more about her work, you can go to her website, marymackey.com, and she spells her name MACKEY, marymackey.com. Or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions. Here with Dr. Mary Mackey, and she's the author of the Earth Song series, which is a series of three books plus a prequel, and that's really what we're about today, The Village of Bones, which is the prequel. And so tell me, why a prequel? Why not write another book and just a series and take us on into the future of the series? You went backwards. What caused you to do that?
Well, the reason I went backwards was that I was the three books in the series involved the time just before the invasion and the first contact, then the invasion itself, and then the next generation of children who are half nomadic, half what I call the mother people. So it follows on a small scale over a period of about 20 years of that. I went back to the prequel because I wanted to look at these societies before the horse was introduced. I wanted to see more thoroughly how they were organized and how they were, what they were like in their flourishing in 10,000 years there. Also, it's interesting that you brought up earlier the thing about compassion, because what you see in The Village of Bones is the beginning of an attempt to both resist evil, you know, resist invasion, resist this, and at the same time, compassion and conversion to the virtues of the mother cultures of peace and compassion and equality and respect for the earth. And so I wanted to look at the origins of that. And I, you know, really The Village of Bones partly is a book about compassion and conversion. And it's done in a slightly different way than the nomadic part, but it leads right into it. I also wanted you to see what the underpinnings were, what the culture was that is flourished for so many years, because it begins to disappear in the first book of the Year the Horses Came, in the first book of the series. And in this, you get to see it in its full flower completely.
So what I get in reading it is like you are talking about, you're imagining what it might be like to hold on to compassion and loving in the wake of this onslaught of aggression.
Yes. How do you do that? And you know, it was a real question for me. I'm not a complete pacifist, but in the series, I was presented with the problem of these people are being attacked, and how do they defend themselves without becoming like the enemy? Because if you become like the enemy, if you're filled with all the hatred that your enemy has, then you've lost. And so how did they do it? So I tried to make them pacifists, and they were slaughtered every time I tried to write a version of that, just like sheep. And so I had to find middle grounds and more subtleties in the ways they defended themselves and the way they thought about their world. And you'll notice, you know, in the books, the nomads aren't all bad. They're not like just a black force. And men certainly are not all bad. There are very wonderful, warm, compassionate male characters throughout these novels. And so I wanted to look at the human subtleties of this kind of situation versus the almost black-white version of invasion and destruction.
So it's like, how do we become effective?
Yes.
Without just succumbing to the same tactics?
Yes. How do we resist without losing our souls?
Good. Well said. Resist without losing our souls. Exactly. And one of the surprising things that came up in the novel, it certainly surprised me, was that you introduce at some point in this particular novel, The Village of Bones, a species other than human. And in researching that, you have come up with some interesting ideas, and but that must have been a surprise to you. I mean, was it?
Well, not really. The first novel in the series traced in the Year of the Horses Game, traced the journey of a young priestess, Marat, all the way across Europe from Brittany to the Black Sea. And in the prequel, her mother carries her from the Black Sea to Brittany as a baby, basically. And it would certainly be boring to simply recapitulate the journey in the other direction. And I also wondered what else was there? What in this great untracked land was there? And being a novelist, I have a great, I can use both imagination and research, and I'm allowed to imagine things that you couldn't, if you were writing a serious archaeological, even sociopolitical piece, you couldn't do. And I thought, could there have been left in the forest other species of human-like people? Because, you know, there used to be at least five. We found at least five different species that were somewhat human. What would they have been like? Were they like, you know how if you find an island, you have remnants sometimes of older species? Or say, if you go to somewhere like Costa Rica, if you go up in the mountains, you'll find animals that were stranded there when the continents, you know, moved. They're very ancient. You know, they're always finding, you know, fossil sharks, all sorts of things. And I thought, well, what if there were just, you know, how did we interact with beings who were human but not Homo sapiens? How would we interact with them? And I thought, you know, would it have been a reaction of hostility? Would it have been a reaction of companionship? And I also became really intrigued with the idea that perhaps, and this is just speculation, that fairy tales that have elves and fairies and gnomes and things in them, were those memories of other human-like creatures that had slightly different ways of living? You might call it different kinds of power. And did we have contact with them and pass? We did have contact with them. We know that we mated with Neanderthals. We have Neanderthal DNA. Did we mate with the other ones? Did we absorb them by mating with them? Did we oppose them? Did we welcome them? And I was so fascinated with the idea of what would it be like to find people, I'm going to call them people, who have human emotions, but who have different physical appearances and perhaps different senses even in some ways. And I was very intrigued, and it was one of the things I wanted to explore. So in the dark forests of what would someday become France, Sabala, my heroine, encounters people who are perhaps the origin of dwarfs and elves and fairies who are a slightly different species, whose bones, some of which we've found and analyzed.
So that's certainly fascinating to think that those early stories might have some sort of basis in actual life.
Because they're such ancient stories.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Ancient tales. And, you know, there was at one point when Homo sapiens, when human beings lived with other humans, other human-like things.
Yes.
We did. And so do we retain any memory of it? And what would it have been like? I just found
it
utterly
kind of
fascinating.
And when in writing about that in reading it, I could feel some compassion for these people that wanted to survive.
Yes.
But then there were these other... So it's kind of a dual thing that at first, Sabala and her tale of leaving where she is and the invasion of the beastmen or the horsemen.
Mm-hmm.
So they are fleeing that. And then she finds this other culture that's fleeing them.
Yes, yes.
You know,
yes.
So it's kind of this double whammy.
And she has to look at it. Yeah.
And so we all have to look at it.
Right.
Like, where are we in this tapestry?
And you know, the other human-like people, the other people who are not human beings but who are human-like, those are like vanishing species, too.
Yes.
I mean, they're rare. Somehow they died out. Were they eliminated? Did they just die because they couldn't compete? Did they die of plagues? Did they just not reproduce? Are we them? You know, did we reproduce with them? And so I was interested. So it's like, you know, we want to defend tigers and keep them from being eliminated, but tigers aren't real friendly if you meet them one-on-one in the jungle. So, you know,
yeah.
So it's a double-edged sword.
Exactly. So just talking about fairy tales, if we can talk about that for a moment, and just talk about the whole idea of the troubadour, the passing on of stories, the storyteller, the traveling
yes.
storyteller. And one of your characters really
yes.
holds that.
One of my main characters is a troubadour, is a storyteller. And actually, the book begins with a poem by him. It's a poem to the earth, a very beautiful poem to the earth. And he writes, you know, he tells stories. He has the oral history. He has the hymns. He has the poems. And he travels around all over Europe from one little culture to another, because this is not a monolithic culture. It's like little different kinds of ways of being in different places. And, you know, sings for his supper, basically. And he brings the stories and histories of people to them. And some of them are myths and some of them are actual history. And it's all mixed up, just the way the ancient epics are. You know, when I was in school, I read Beowulf and I read, you know, those epics. And I thought of, you know, what stories those must have come out of. In fact, in Beowulf, you know, you remember there's perhaps Grendel and his mother. They almost sound like different human species that aren't Homo sapiens, if you think about it that way. Now, that's just pure speculation. No decent professor of ancient history would ever find any proof of it, I don't think. But I love to, as a novelist, I love to play with the idea that those monsters from the past might also be some kinds of memories of different encounters.
Right, exactly. So if once we have written language, like what you're writing about is pre-written language.
Yes.
And that's where it takes place. And once we have written language, there's a shift that happens in culture.
A major shift, yes. As a matter of fact, when the old myths are written down, they're changed profoundly. For example, when Beowulf was recorded, it was recorded by monks, and they took out the word Thor, who was one of the gods in it, and they put in the word God, as in the Judeo-Christian God, so that they would change and modify it from the original, so that the myths, so that they're changed and modified in every, and then they were frozen forever in the manuscripts in history. These stories that had been organic and changed probably by their audiences and the troubadours themselves. And they were memorized, you know. If you look at the old, for example, I just go back to Beowulf. If you look at that, it's written in a kind of, it doesn't, not a rhymed verse, but in alliteration and in special beats on the lines so you can remember it the way you can remember a song. And people remembered hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of lines of them. It was a kind of tray, a craft that people learned. Once it's written down, you no longer have to do that and you no longer have the changes. So it's a big change.
I think that you've said that that they've done research for people who are oral cultures. They have better memory.
They do, yes. They tend to have better memories.
Now, we don't have to remember anything. We can just
Google it. We can just Google it. Or like people can't read roadmaps.
And I think that you've written down, and this is true of me, like my ability to remember the multiplication tables.
Yes.
Is I'm having to refresh myself. I don't always remember.
Because I'm always using a calculator now.
I know. It's like dependent, starting to be dependent.
You don't use it. It tends to atrophy.
Right.
Yeah. And, you know, I say very clearly in all these books that there's no written language. I say that as a real thing. But in this book, in The Village of Bones, we have a sacred book, which is written, which is a secret script that, you know, that actually does exist at the time. And there is some speculation that there was at least 6,000 years ago a written religious language that might be untranslatable. It's called Cretan Linear B that nobody can translate. There's no Rosetta Stone for it. And so it's possible that there did have, for limited or, you know, religious purposes, there might have been a script.
And this might have appeared more as hieroglyphics.
Yeah,
so
we don't
maybe.
Yeah, we don't really know.
We can't interpret it.
What we do know is that there's a myth that the great mother priestess, the Cumaean Sibyl, went to the last king of Rome with 9 books. And she said, these are books of prophecy that will tell you everything in the future.
Now, this is in
this
fact,
is real.
This is,
well,
it's historical.
Yeah, this is historical written record.
Okay.
Now, we don't know, you know, if this is true, but it's as true as any written history. And so, yes, it's written down. Tarquinius, I think, the last king of Rome. And she offered him these 9 books. And he said, how much are they? And she named this outrageous price. And he said, that's too much. And she destroyed in front of him 3 of the books. He said, oh, that's horrible, you know. Well, what do you sell me the 6 for? And he said, she said a big price again, and then she destroyed them when he refused, and finally he paid the whole price for 3 books, which Rome consulted at every important point in their history from then on.
Wow. I'm here with Mary Mackey. She's the author of the Earth Song series, many other novels as well, and poetry. And her most recent novel is a prequel in the Earth Song series called The Village of Bones. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions.
New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in Conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available